We thank you for the fact that you're our God and that you watch out for us and take care of us and everything else. It's incredible what you are capable of and your infinite ability and your eternal power. And we pray this evening as we look at your display of this in words that we will be reminded of how small we are, that we wouldn't be lifted up in pride, but also see how great you are. And we love you. We thank you for you and your infinite wisdom sending your Son to give us hope beyond this life, but also that you're a great God that we can enjoy the world that you've created. So help us this evening to see that display. And this we pray in Christ's name. Amen. If you take Bibles and turn to Job 38, and this is the section where God starts talking. And the name of this lesson is Cleaving the Clamor, cutting through all the clamor that has taken place, the guys arguing with one another for all this time and doing all of that. And they have been doing this, and God comes through with an unignorable voice and statement that he makes certain things, and very clear. You can't get away from what he's going to say here. And for us, when we get into this, I'm just going to tell you this. We're going to answer some things and talk about some things, but then we're going to spend a major portion of just reading through what God has to say. Okay, so that's going to be a lot of our time. But initially, we need to get some things settled here or discussed when it comes to this passage that we're going to look at. So our introductory issues we have in your notes: the first movement of God's speech is panoramic in scope. Its topics range wide world. I would say this, it's not even worldwide, it's universe-wide. What he's going to talk about, what he's going to discuss. But the first thing that we see in all of this is what we kind of looked at last week. It makes this statement, verse 1, "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind." And we said for us, there's already been a display going on before Job ever hears God speak. Elihu is speaking. The previous two chapters is hinting at the clouds that are around him and the lightning bolts that are going off and the light display that's taking place. And there seems to be sprinkles and sometimes even rains mixed in. And you have all of this going on, and it's coming towards this group, and they're about to get deluged by this storm here. And it's when on that point that Elihu gets done and God speaks out of this whirlwind. And when you have this, the thunder, as Elihu has already stated, is God's majestic voice. Okay, think of it this way: when it comes to God's voice, he can speak in a still small voice. Okay, he showed that to Elijah when Elijah needed to hear him. But God's voice is oftentimes described as trumpets, thunder. In the book of Revelation, it's the sound of many waters. And I tell people, if you want to know what many waters is like, if you've ever been to Niagara Falls and you've come directly up against the falls, you can't hear anything else. You can be screaming at one another next to each other and you can't hear. You go, why? Because the voice of many waters coming over there. It's even worse if you go underneath it, if you go behind the falls, you don't hear anything. You have to go way back down the tunnel to be able to talk to one another again, because the water is so loud. God's voice is unmistakable. It can pierce through anything when it needs to. You want a psalm about God's voice? I believe it's Psalm 24 that talks about the fact of what God's voice is capable of doing. Shafts of lightning are his servants. Weather is a tool in his hand to deal with both man and land and be able to do that. So here is one thing I want us to at least acknowledge. The storm is not a sign of God's absence, but a sign of his presence. And the passage I have there is Nahum 1 in verse 3. And you may not want to attempt to go find that and then come back. I've actually marked it in my Bible so we'll quickly be able to find it. Nahum is written to the city of Nineveh. They're about to suffer the judgment of God. It's about 100 years after Jonah showed up, and they repented of their sins after Jonah had been in the whale, and he comes and preaches, and they get right. But they have 100 years of being bad, and they're just a wicked city, and God says, okay, I'm going to finally judge you. And this is the announcement of judgment, and it starts off in Nahum 1, verse 2, that God is a jealous God, and the Lord revengeth. Okay, he's going to take out the judgment that deserved to be given out. Verse 3, the Lord is slow to anger, great in power, and will not at all acquit the wicked. A statement of Exodus chapter 32. The Lord hath his way in the whirlwind, and in the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. Now, here's how to picture this. Ever see the westerns, the people in the westerns are off in the desert and they're riding across the desert and you can tell they're coming. You go, why? This cloud of dust coming up there, you know, the Lone Ranger, you know, the cloud of dust. You can tell they're coming by the clouds being raised. So it is, what it's talking about is this case, that the clouds of the sky are like God's footpath. You're noticing, you see these things, and it's just a display, God's there. And that Nahum talks about the fact that he has his way in the whirlwind and the storm. He's going, and that's his pathway. He walks right through it. That's where he's going. It's not that he's leaving that because there's a storm or those type of things. That storm is a sign of his presence. And it's a good reminder for us, because at times when we go through storms and we go through bad things and difficulties in life, and there is this idea that God is what? You're going through the storm. You're saying he's absent. But the fact in that storm, God's there because it doesn't bother him. In fact, it's a show of his power that he is there. You think about the New Testament. In the New Testament, you have experienced people who have no problem sailing on water that are panicked by a storm that they're in, and the Lord is sitting in the bow of the boat with his head on a pillow sleeping. You go, why? Storm doesn't bother him any. You go, why? Because the storm is a display of his power. It's like home to him. He's there. And for us, right from the start, we may just get this understanding that a storm is not an absence of God's presence. It's a, what? A display of his presence. I mean, think about when God appeared on Mount Sinai. He comes down and it's a cloud and there's thunder and lightning and the sounding of trumpets. It's not an absence of God being there. It's a display of his power that he is there. So when God speaks out of this whirlwind, this is not, he's trying to make it through the whirlwind to talk to no, it's just a display of his power, and it's another way of displaying that he's there. So you have this, okay? The storm's not a sign of God's absence, a sign of his presence. And he is there, and he's not silent. Throughout this whole time, as we've looked at Job, what's been the problem for Job? God's not, he's not hearing me, he's not answering me. He has accused God of that numerous times. And here you have, an answer from God is exactly what Job had been after. Job wanted God to talk to him. You know, you're being silent right now. You're giving me the silent treatment, and I haven't heard anything from you. That means you're not there. That was kind of the accusation head. And as you go through, the quotations of Job and Elihu that surface in God's answer show that he has been present and listening all along. Because God's going to quote Job sometimes. And then sometimes you're going to quote Elihu, and you're going, well, I don't know that he was here. You know, he was quiet all this time. Nope, he's been listening in great detail as he's gone through this, and he's been present and listening all along. So he's not silent anymore. He's answering. Job has spent his time. You could go through what Job says, and over again he's saying, I wish God would answer me. But then you have this. The Lord's opening salvo is aimed squarely at Job. God later credits Job with words that are right in contrast to those of his three friends. But when we're going to read the opening statement here, he's opening up and he's just saying, Job, you are wrong, what you've been doing. And it's not candy-coated at all. But eventually does say that he's doing much better than his friends were. His friends were way off. But this does not mean that all of Job's speeches have been entirely without fault. He has made statements he shouldn't. So I just want us to read this statement here that the Lord opens up with, verse 2 of Job chapter 38. And I'll try and read it with some of the depth of it, but I don't know if I can do it here. But here we go. Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare, if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it? I mean, this opening statement, who is this? And I've underlined that word in verse 3, gird up thy loins like a man. It's not the normal word for a man here. Usually the word's Adam or Ish. Okay, that's the Hebrew word for it. This word's Gibor. You go, what's that? This is a word normally used for men who are heroes. He's like, okay, you want to come out? Okay, you think you've been bold here, proclaiming things about me? Come on out. Gird up your loins for battle here. That you think you're going to prove something to me? Well, come on out. We'll go face to face here. We'll see who the winner's going to be. I mean, this is what God's declaring to him. And the first movement of God's answer tests what Job knows. The opening verses reiterate the Hebrew word for knowledge. I can't really show you in the English, but as you go through here in these first five verses, the word knowledge is there over and over again in the Hebrew language. He's going, what do you know? Do you know these things? And for him, the opening salvo is, were you here when we started the construction project of the universe? Were you there helping measure out the lines with the surveyors? Were you doing this type of thing? What did we frame it to? All that stuff that's here. What did we anchor it to? You got knowledge on that? So he's starting off and going, there are certain things you don't know. And what he's going to do is go through and show how little Job, can't do, but how little he knows. Because Job has questioned whether God knows what's going on or not. That's been Job's major argument. So what the question is, and understand how it starts off, look at the first question that God has for Job, and what's the interrogative? It's not why. We have spent all these chapters hearing why, which is okay, because thinking about this, why is instinctive when we're faced with the inexplicable? It's the mark of a thinking soul. I mean, I put it this way. It's a sign that you're human. When bad things happen, you go through and you retrace and you try and go, was I at fault? Why did this happen? And we try and figure that out. It's our human nature. It's part of, and it's a good thing because it's part of how we solve problems. Because we ask the why questions and what could we do to prevent these things. But sometimes it's the wrong question to ask, and it was for Job because he keeps asking why. Why did this happen to me, and why did this occur to me, and I can't believe this is the type of thing that happened to me. God asks, as he goes through, God could have answered Job's why. We have an answer in the prologue, but he chooses not to answer Job. I mean, we know what's going on. We've got the curtains pulled back. Oh, this is a battle between God and Satan, proving with Job that, there will be people who will serve God for nothing. But Job has no idea of this. God's answer to Job's question is a counter question. Job asks why, God asks who. Okay, and that's the question that, as we said, when we get into our why, we've got to break out of that when we're suffering and go, who? And ultimately it's this, what's next? Okay, who did this? Oh, God did. Okay, if God's allowed this, what's the what next? So he's getting Job to focus on what he's like by all these questions. You've got the who. You don't have the why, but you've got the who behind it. And ultimately, in the end, Job gets the what next. Pray for your friends and offer sacrifices for them. Now, if God could have explained, and if the reader already knows the explanation, then why did he not let Job in on it? Okay, Job never finds out why these bad things happen. Just thinking through Scripture and what the rest of Scripture has, one of them is to avert pride. Can you imagine if you were told by God, hey, I and Satan were having a discussion, and guess what? You proved my point. Good job. Hey. Yeah, I beat the devil. Yeah, okay, that's an issue. And think about in the Scripture, when really incredible things happen to people, God had to bring things in to stall them and to stomp on their pride. For instance, you have the Apostle Paul, who's able to see into the third heaven. You go, what's the third heaven? It's not referring to the sky or the stars. It's referring to the place where God's at. And he's able to see things which he said, I'm not allowed to utter, but I got to see these things. But then you see this, that he's given a what? A thorn in the flesh. And you go, why? To keep him humble? You know, as we've talked about, some think that the issue for the Apostle Paul was that he had problems with his eyes. It seems that's one of the indicators in the book of Galatians, that he had some problems with his eyes. And so I've thought about that. In the one case, if it was this fact that his eyes were a thorn in the flesh, he had seen things that no one else had ever seen. So what is God doing? He's embarrassing him by his eyes to keep him humble so he doesn't brag about this. Okay? Sometimes God has us suffer. He doesn't explain it, but it's a way for us, if he did explain it to us, we would be like, wow, look, yeah, look at what I accomplished, what I got through. No. God doesn't tell him, A, to avert pride, keep it from happening. Secondly, to negate the assumption that the prologue explains all our suffering as well. Okay? Here's the thing. You don't go through bad things because God and Satan are having a conversation about you. Talked about this morning. Satan's probably not all that worried about you. You know, what do you mean? I'm really important. No, probably not. You end up doing things that are wrong because, well, Satan or one of his angels, which is more likely one of his angels, is appealing and pulling you to go a certain direction, and your internal trait of your flesh just goes with it. But more than likely, Satan can't be everywhere at once, can't be everywhere at all times. He can't be. So he's got other things that he's worried about. So we can't just all automatically suggest, oh, suffering is because God and Satan are having a conversation and, you know, I'm suffering because they're talking about me. No, that's not probably what's going on. God just leaves it so Job never knows this and doesn't even need to think and assume this. But third of all, to preclude or to keep this from happening, the presumption that God owes every sufferer an explanation. We got done with Job, and Job got an explanation. I mean, think about this. All of our suffering, if we did suffer, God would have to talk to us verbally, more than likely. This is why this happened or whatever. God doesn't work that way right now. He's got all that we need right now in the word that he's already given us. So he doesn't tell us, just like in Job's time, even though he's talking to people directly, he doesn't tell Job. Just to kind of let us know that not all suffering has an answer in this life. So, question, why? Well, the answer is another question, who? And it's not really an answer to what Job is looking for. But by the time he's done, Job's going, don't need an explanation. Didn't know what I was talking about. I'm sorry. And that's how God's going to get started here. So as you read through Job chapter 38 and 39, we're now going to get to the heart of reading through some of the elements here. Here's what God does. He breaks in what he's going to say into two sections. One is what we would call physical science, and the other one is life science. For the first part of chapter 38, God is going to be talking about all that stuff that's out there that's scientific that has no life to it. The universe, stars, water, weather, things under the earth, geology, all of these things that you would have studied in a science class that would have had astronomy or geology or weather or these type of things as part of the science class, that's physical science. But what God's going to do right at the end of 38 and right in all the way through 39 is he's going to start talking about things that are alive and how they manage their life and whatever, and there's things that they know how to do, and you're going, can you do this, Job? Can you cause them to do this? Can you cause these things to do that? Can you cause this living thing to do this? Can you cause this living thing to do that? Did you cause this living thing to do this? Did you create it this way? And so he's just going to go through animal life. So what we have here is, for us, I tell people, it's like God gives us for the old-timers, the Mutual of Omaha. You know, we're going to look at all the animals and all the unique things they are and the different ones that are out there and that type of thing. And now it's, you know, probably like Blue Planet or Planet Earth or these type of things. And they have these magnificent pictures. And you're like, how in the world did they get these shots of these whales in the ocean and these type of things? And then, you know, it's like watching some science program, not science fiction, okay, science film where it's picturing the globe and then it's picturing the universe and giving you, you know, and you're just kind of going, God's just giving all these snapshots. And Job's just sitting there going, wow, didn't do that. So let's read through some of these that God has here. And remember, he's proving a point. Job, you think you're a know-it-all? Mm-mm, you're not. Verse number 5, he's talking about who laid out the earth, okay? God did it by a word. But he laid the foundations. And then verse 7, I just need to mark this verse here. It says this, when I laid the foundation of the earth, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Okay, so when the earth got its foundation, there was someone singing praise to God. Go, who's that? Angels. That's what that verse is referencing. The angels were created before creation. You go, how long before creation? I don't know. Are they created beings? Yes, absolutely. But when God is there and he's setting us up and he gets the foundations and you start off, let there be light. There's a course that goes on in heaven of praise. And so you get this idea. You weren't even there at the foundation and you weren't even there to hear the magnificent choir of angels singing when that took place. Yeah, you missed out on that, didn't you? So he's making that statement. Verse 8, who shut up the sea with doors when it break forth as if it had issued out of the womb. I when I made the cloud the garment thereof and the thickness a swaddling band for it and break up it for my decree a place and set bars and doors in verse 11 and said, hitherto shalt thou come, but no further. And here shall thou proud waves be stayed. What he's talking about? Creation. When you start off, you have the firmament above, firmament below, and then you have the separation between the waters there in the, what is it, the second day of creation? I'm forgetting my order here. But then eventually when you have the waters open up and you have actual waters there and you have dry land suddenly appearing, and God says, I made the boundaries. I decided water was going to appear here. And water's not going to be here. There's going to be land here. There's a boundary. It's not going any farther than that. Who set those boundaries? I did. I kept the water from going any further than it should have. I put the boundaries up. I did this. Or how about this, verse 12, hast thou commanded the morning since thy days and caused the dayspring to know his place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth, that the wicked might be shaken out of it? It's basically saying this, did you ever start the day by saying, okay, time for sun to come up? As I said this morning, some of us are probably going, eh, I don't want the sun to come up. that might be what we do, but none of us have ever had the ability to say, sun, time to come up. Nope. It does its thing. I mean, how does it do its thing? Because God has made it a certain way and has our world do this for the last 7,000 years by his command, and it does what it's supposed to do, and mankind has never been able to change that. Verse number 16. Hast thou entered into the springs of the sea, or hast thou walked in search of the depth? Have the gates of death been opened unto thee, or hast thou seen the doors of the shadow of death? This is what he's talking about there. We've gotten down to, the question now is like, yes, we have. You know, a couple of guys have gotten in the Mariana Trench and gone down 7 miles to the deepest ocean on the earth. You're like, okay, that's a couple of people, but that's really not all that impressive. You realize we haven't even gotten outside through the crust of the earth. The only way that we know what goes on in the center of the earth is when it decides to burst forth in volcanoes and that type of thing, so we're getting an idea of what's down there, but we haven't been down there. And God's just simply saying to Job, have you ever been in the center of the earth? You know, when he's talking about the death, he's talking about Sheol, the depths, the grave. He goes, have you been there? You know what's underneath you? Never gotten far enough down to see right down to the core? Mm-mm, no, you haven't. Okay. Well, let's go to another subject. Hast thou, verse 18, perceived the breadth of the earth, declarest if thou knowest it all? Verse 19, where is the way where light dwelleth, and for darkness where is the place thereof, that thou shouldest take hold of the bound thereof, and thou shouldest know the paths of the house thereof? How does light start? Where does darkness come from? How's that work out? We're like, well, we can turn on light and we can create light. He's just talking, where's light come from? How does it even exist? Job, you got an answer for this? Or he starts talking about the weather, verse number 20 or 22. Hast thou entered into the treasures of the snow, or hast thou seen the treasures of hail, which I have reserved against the time of trouble, against the day of battle and war? By what way is the light parted, which scattered the east wind upon the earth, who hath divided a watercourse for the overflowing of waters, or the way for lightning and thunder, to cause it to rain on the earth where no man is, on the wilderness wherein there is no man, to satisfy the desolate waste ground, and to cause the bud of the tender herb to spring forth? Hath the rain a father, or hath the begotten the drops of dew, out of whose womb came the ice and the hoary frost of the earth that hath gendered it? Verse 30, the waters are hid with a stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. He just kind of goes, okay, have you ever been to the place where I store all my hail, the snow? Have you ever thought about this? As a kid, I was like, how do you get a cloud go over and it's loaded with water and it doesn't fall? Because you can tell at times there's a storm coming, because it's a really dark cloud and it's really tall and whatever, and it goes over your head and nothing falls out of it, and you're like, and then 4 miles down the road they're getting pelted by hail. Where did it get stored? How did this get birthed? You know, if you want to think of it that way, where all this came out. Job, do you know how to do this? No? Okay. Well, all right. Well, let's talk about something else. That's way beyond your grasp. How about this? Canst thou bind the sweet influences of the Pleiades, or loose the bands of Orion? Can thou bring forth Mazoroth in his season? That's talking about the signs of the zodiac in the sky, the 12 different things there. Or canst thou guide Arcturus with his suns, the bears there that I think, if I remember correctly, are the North Star and all of that, the bears, the Little Dipper and the Big Dipper, and they make different bears. I mean, he's making a joke of this. Could you reach up and and this is normally you see it in the winter sky at night, the belt of Orion, the straight three stars across. You can usually spot them because they're usually directly overhead and they're obvious that they're there, and then you got the little box and whatever. And in ancient culture, people would point to it and go, oh, there's Orion, he's got the animal in his arm, you know, and this. And they could see stars better back then. They didn't have light pollution that we have now. But they would picture this, and God just kind of goes, could you reach up and, like, unfasten the belt of Orion? Which to us, you know, is humorous because those stars aren't anywhere near each other. In fact, we were somewhere else in the universe, billions of miles away. Those stars wouldn't even be close to each other. They wouldn't be lined up next to each other like a belt. It's just from our perspective, we see those stars as a belt. And he just kind of goes, could you reach up and, like, you know, move those if you wanted to? You know, could you get the bears to move along? Come on, move. No, we can't do anything with that in the sky. We can just stare at it. Can't do anything with it. Canst thou lift up thy voice to the clouds, that the abundance of waters cover thee? Canst thou send out lightnings, verse 35, that they may go and say unto thee, here we are. Who hath put wisdom in the inward parts and hath given understanding to the heart? Who can number the clouds in wisdom? You know, you want to start counting sands of sea? Go ahead, count the clouds, feel free. Verse 38, when the dust groweth into hardness and the clouds cleave fast together, how do things dry out in the earth? Want to talk about that process? And there's a process, but why does the process take place? So all of that is just, he's laying stuff out here, and Job's not able to go, oh yeah, I know how that happens. No, not a single thing. Oh yeah, I could do it. No. The answer is always no. You know, who does this? Did you do this? No. Did you? No. So right now, Job's 0 for 1,000. Okay, so maybe we'll make it a little easier. Let's go to animal life that surrounds him. He can at least get to those things. And God starts talking about this, verse 39. Wilt thou hunt the prey for the lion and the appetite of the young lions when they couch in their dens and abide in the covert to lie wait? Who provideth for the raven his food when his young ones cry unto God and they wander for lack of meat? I mean, both of these animals, both lions and ravens, are carnivores, and you say, well, how do lions get their food and the young get fed? They find a way. They figured it out, how to get food. Ravens are scavengers. They are ones who take care of garbage in the Middle East. They take care of dead things. We would talk about vultures in our culture and that type of thing, but that's what they are. They have no store of stuff. They eat right there what they're going to eat. They don't take it back to their nest or whatever. They just eat it right there. And how do they make sure, does God make sure they get fed all the time? You know, it's not like you can go find dead bodies everywhere. You know, with cadavers are us, you know, go down to the store and get it. You know, the ravens aren't getting that. So how do they get fed all the time? I mean, how do they find food? Or how about this? Knowest thou the time when the wild goats of the rock bring forth, and cast thou mark when the hinds do calf? Canst thou number the months that they fulfill? Or knowest thou the time when they're supposed to bring forth? They bow themselves down, they bring forth young ones, they cast their sorrows. If you make a study of animals, some animals have a very short pregnancy, and some have an incredibly long pregnancy. And he just kind of goes, Job, did you tell the animals when to give birth, how long they were supposed to keep the babies in? Did you do this, Job? Or how about this one? Verse 5, who hath sent out the wild donkeys free, who hath loosed the bands of the wild donkeys, whose house I have made the wilderness and the barren land is dwelling. He scorneth the multitude of the city, neither regardeth he the crying of the driver. We don't have wild donkeys running around here, but we do have such thing as wild horses. How do they get everything taken care for them? They don't live in a house or a barn where they get fed all the time. How do they know where to go and get their food and forage for that? And how do they keep themselves safe in those regions? Or how about in verse number 9, and I'll just give you this. will the unicorn, okay, in our translation, You read in other translations, they talk about the rhinoceros, and you're kind of going, What we're talking about here is a wild oxen, okay? Like cattle that are wandering the plains. We had that. They had it back in Job's time. These wild oxen that don't have a crib, verse 9, a manger to eat at. I mean, where do they get their food from? How do they get fed? Job, you ever taken care of that? How about this one? And I love this one. Verse 13. Gavest thou the goodly wings unto the peacocks, or wings and feathers to the ostrich? Okay, you have birds, and they have wings and feathers. Why? Because they fly. Peacocks? I compared it this morning. You ever think about a peacock trying to fly? They can go along the ground and get a little bit of, you know, but they aren't going to be flying up in the sky. It's like a wedding dress, gown and everything being behind them. Can you imagine them trying to get off the ground with that? No. But God gave them feathers, like other birds, and wings. How about ostriches? They got wings. Why don't they fly? In fact, they're so silly. Look at this, verse 14. These are ones who leave their eggs in the earth and warm them in the dust, forget that the foot may crush them or that the wild beast may break them. She is hardened against her young as though they were not hers. Her labor is in vain without fear because God hath deprived her of wisdom, neither hath he imparted to her understanding. What time she lifted up herself on high, she scorneth the horse and his rider. He simply goes this. Okay, we use the term bird brain. Okay, an ostrich is a bird brain. According to God, he goes, why? Because I didn't give them certain knowledge. They just leave their eggs where they're at. They're not like other birds that go and nest and protect that for weeks and months. So they'll protect that egg and take care of that and guard it and whatever. The ostrich just drops it in the ground there, covers it up, and wanders off. And then the ostrich, instead of flying, what does she do? It talks about this then. She's racing the horses. I'm like, why don't you fly? No, they love running. One of the fastest creature on two legs. And you've seen them being raced at times because you can climb on their back. And they think that that's grand fun. And you're going, but you're a bird. You have wings and you have feathers. What's wrong with you? Well, God limited the knowledge of the ostrich to live one way different than others, and it's ingrained in them. You have this passage about the horse. Verse 19, hast thou given the horse strength? Hast thou clothed his neck with thunder? Canst thou make him afraid as a grasshopper? The glory of his nostrils is terrible, a snorting you can hear for miles. Verse 21, he paweth in the valley, he rejoiceth in his strength, he goeth to meet the armed man, he mocketh at fear and is not affrighted, neither turneth he back from the sword, the quiver rattleth against him, the glittering spear in his shield, he swalloweth the ground with the fierceness and rage, neither believeth he that it is the sound of the trumpet, he saith among the trumpets, aha, and he smelleth the battle afar off, and the thunder of captains and the shouting. You go, what do you have? Why did they use horses on the battlefield? Why don't they use some other creatures? Because horses at times could be the most stable thing in a battlefield. They'd run through all sorts of things and all sorts of congestion and through the clamor of battle, and they'd be willing to do this. And you go, did God create them that way to be bold like that? And the answer is absolutely. I mean, you can get horses to be skittish at times and the like, but there is a boldness to horses that they'll run you down. Get out of their way. Because they've got the strength to be able to do that. And you go, who put that in there? God did. How about this? Verse 26, doth the hawk fly by wisdom and stretch her wings towards the south? Doth the eagle mount up at the command and make her nest on high? He just simply says this, what about migration? I mean, what causes a bird to fly 5,000 miles to the same location again, and they don't have GPS? How do they get there? How is that pre-programmed in there? Did someone take them to map class and go, okay, you know, you've just been born, but we're going to migrate 5,000 miles, and here's what we're going to do. And they've got it in them already. How do you get whales that go 10,000 miles across the face of the globe from one location to another, and they do this every year, and they come back to the same location, and they know how to get there, and they have no road signs, no signpost, nothing? You have butterflies that will make the trip from one location to another, and they do it every single year, and they follow the same path over and over again for generations. And you go, how is this even possible that they know where they're supposed to be going? Did mankind teach them this? You know, let's teach you new tricks. No. It's in them. God put it there. He put that knowledge there so that they can find their way. And then you have the eagle, where it makes this statement, she dwelleth and abideth in the rock, upon the crag of the rock, in the strong place, from thence she seeketh the prey. Her eyes behold afar off, her young ones also suck up blood where there are slain. There she is. You go, why do eagles make nests in the rocks? Why don't they make them in trees? Or on the ground? Because God created them with the understanding, I can see a long ways, I can protect my young by being in the rocks here. I can see far off, I can gather what I need to and bring it back, and no one's going to get it. And you say, who taught him that? Job, you didn't. You know, you didn't have eagle school that you were teaching during this the past couple of years. No, this just happened because I taught them this. Now, God stops at this point. He could go on. I mean, we've missed out on creatures, okay? We were talking about this morning. We missed out on some creatures. You want to talk about giraffe? How do you get the blood flow to a giraffe's brain without it draining back out? You know, why don't they go, you know, we were talking about this. Why don't they black out? Because the blood's not getting to their head. How's it stay up there? Well, they got a unique blood system. And you talk about other creatures that are weird. A platypus, a mammal, it's got a bill on it, and it lays eggs. Really? I've been getting on my feed recently. Anteaters. Anteaters are weird-looking creatures. You know, they got this tail that looks like its nose. You sometimes get confused because it's the long, narrow thing and that. And, you know, they go around, and that tongue comes out, and it's like, it looks like a tube, and it's like... It's picking stuff up and whatever, and you're like, okay. You know, I don't know if I'd want it as a pet, and one person seems to have it as that, but okay, whatever. But you just look at the zoo. You go to the zoo, and every time you go to the zoo, and if you go to different zoos, there's always an animal there. You're going, there's an animal like that? And you see some of the pictures of the sea creatures and the colors on them no painter could ever come up with. I got this like tapeworm that's like blue and white and orange, and it's like translucent in its coloring. And you're going, nobody could get color like that. We could go through all of animal creation, and there's unique things about each animal, and you're going, how did that get there? Well, it wasn't us putting it there. And it wasn't through billions of years of evolutionary process, because everything would have died off in the first couple of days because they didn't realize, oh, I need a heart. I need a brain, you know, these type of things. No, God created them like this, and it was automatically there. So as you go through, and God, all of these things have been basically questions. Every once in a while I make statements to clarify, you know, did you not understand the question? I'll give you some declarative statements. But all the questions that you get, okay, all the interrogatives, all the questions, are declarations designed to make several points about God. There's four things that God is doing to Job as he goes through with this, okay? First, God's generative power implies sustaining power. You go, what does that mean? What God created, he can take care of. Colossians 1 tells us that by Christ, everything was made, but then by him all things consist. That's the idea. They continue on. God not only created these really unique things in our universe, he's able to take care of them in all of their uniqueness. They're not the same. They're all different. They got different needs. They got different areas that they're okay with. You know, some love the extreme cold. I was thinking about this. Recently, I saw a video of a fish that is paper thin. You can see right through it. You can see all of its organs. You know where it's located? It's located 7 miles down. You're going, wait a second, that's the type of pressure that can crush submarines and do all this type of thing. And you got this creature down there that's just paper thin. You're like, how is that possible you live down here? Why don't you have like a big armored shell on here and just swim around the bottom of the ocean? No. Some of the spindliest creatures in the world are in some of the worst pressure areas in the existence. You go, how did they get there? They like it there. Bring them to the surface or anyplace else and they'll die off real quick. God puts creatures in different environments and takes care of them in the extreme cold or the extreme hot, wherever he's placed them. And so they got unique things that they need to sustain them as far as their life. So if God's created unique creatures, he can also sustain them in those unique environments, wherever they're at. Second of all, God's providential care for creation implies awareness and compassion, that God knows all these things about his creation and knows all of their needs, and he's just laying them out here. They need this, and they need that, and they got this capability. This is a God that's paying attention to needs. We forget the statement when God is talking about birds, that he uses birds to illustrate the fact that he cares for the sparrows who don't have a barn, don't gather for winter, and they still have food. And what is his statement after that? Are ye not much more than they? If I take care of the sparrows who are just flitting around from place to place and have no home and they just gather whatever is there immediately in front of them, aren't you worth more than that? And does that not mean that if I'm concerned about them, I'm going to take care of you? Okay, what you're seeing here is, if I take care of these things, I'm going to take care of you. He's answering Job's question, you don't care. Okay, you haven't been listening. God's creative sovereignty implies the rights of ownership. If you make something, we have this in our culture, you make something, you get a patent for it, it's yours. You can do whatever you want with it. So Job's been questioning the fact of whether or not God's got a right to do what he does. And he's just kind of going, I think I own all the things here. I created them, which means they're now my responsibility. I can do whatever I want with them. So Job, you're questioning something that is my divine right to be able to do. And lastly, this, God's inventive diversity implies imagination and skill. Not all the animals are the same. Zoos are thankful for that, because you could walk into the first exhibit and be like, oh, we're done. Okay, we've seen all the animals. They're all the same. Walk back out. No, we've got a very diverse God when it comes to his creative skill. And it's reflected in the way that we can be creative. I mean, we're in the image of God, and so we have creativity and skill. But when you look at what God's done, and no universe is the same, no galaxies are the same, the planets aren't the same, they got different chemical makeups and minerals on them. I mean, different temperatures, they swing around on their side. I mean, all sorts of stuff in the universe, and the animals are all different, and you just kind of go, I'm glad my God's creative. He doesn't do everything the same, which means in our life, we're not all living the same life that everybody else is living. God uniquely paints our life in different ways and shapes and forms, that God is doing these things. And you're saying, well, why does God do all of these things? Ultimately, in the end, God is going to get praise. I want to read this statement, because he did make mention that God sometimes just reigns. God made the statement that he sometimes reigns in the desert where no one is at, causes things to grow there. I mean, why? Why would you do that? If no one's going to be there, why even take care for it? And one preacher has made this statement. Why does God do these things? It's because the works of God in creation praise him. In distant deserts, millions of flowers will bloom, blush with vivid colors, give off sweet fragrance, and never be touched or seen or smelled by anybody but God. God, it seems, wanted Job to think about this very thing. Creation praises God by simply being what it was created to be in all its incredible variety. And since most of creation is beyond the awareness of mankind, in the reaches of space, in the heights of mountains, at the bottoms of seas, it wasn't created merely to serve purposes that have to do with us. It was created for the enjoyment of God. One of the tragedies of growing up is that we get used to things. What a wonderful experience it is when God grants us a moment in which we don't take anything for granted, but see the world as though it was invented yesterday. We should pray for the eyes of children again when they saw everything for the first time. These are the eyes we need to see, the unending wisdom of God running throughout all of the world. I mean, the world was created for his praise, and it ought to be that we are praising him because we're going, this is incredibly the case. And even with our own selves and our own body, I think this is in Lee's restroom down the hallway, the quote of the verse, we are beautifully and wonderfully made. Our world is beautifully made. And who gets the praise for that? God. If we see that, so. Any questions or thoughts on this? But, I mean, my advice, go home, you know, tune out the evolutionary stuff, but watch National Geographic or Planet Earth, or, you know, if you got the Mutual of Omaha, put it up on the screen with your 16-millimeter video, or whatever you may have. And in our household, if we ever watch those things, when it gets to the animals chasing each other, it's like, nope, skip to something else, because we know what's going to happen in the end. We don't want to watch the meal at the end. But, you know, this is a type of thing that we ought to do, that the God who takes care for a small cell. I mean, you look in a microscope and you're like, what a waste of time. It's magnified 400 times. So it's 400 times larger than what it is, and I'm looking at it, and it's got its own propulsion system sometimes I'm looking at it, and it's got its own, you know, way of collecting food, and you're going, it has no brain. How is it doing this? The single cell organism, how is this possible? God does things on a grand scale and even the miniature scale, and it all praises him. I mean, you just can't get away from it. So for us to suddenly go to God, you don't know what you're doing. Who are you? It's a pretty bold statement. And that's what he's trying to get across to Job.